Welcome to Shattering Myths, the healthy alternative to those who have come to recognize that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission here is to know who is working against our interests, to understand how and why they are doing so, because exposing such schemes, even when they're political, religious, and patriotic, isn't hateful. It is caring. In our concluding hour, we're going to return to Yosha's statements during the Sermon on the Mount for the express purpose of exposing the false religion known as Christianity. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is 877-376-45. Before we get to the news that I have outlined to discuss today, I do want to comment on Iraq. Iraq is now embroiled in a full-on civil war. It's not just Mosul that is controlled now by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It's also much of the north of Iraq and most of the Anbar province as well, which borders Syria. It now appears that what was a border between the two countries actually has been morphed into just a terrorist zone. Now, what's interesting here is, of course, that there was no civil war in Iraq before America broke the country. There was virtually no terrorism in Iraq before America broke the country. The media and politicians are going to do what SRN did today and say, well, the government needs to get control over this rebellion. Well, the government's worse than ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The government is comprised almost exclusively of Shia Muslims that are loyal to the mullahs in Tehran. They are worse than the terrorists who are now controlling cities like Kirkuk and Mosul. This is a gargantuan issue, and it is a consequence of America's invasion of Iraq, and there is no solution here. We can't return to Iraq and try to fix what we broke, and there's no way of fixing it. Sunni Muslims outnumber Shia Muslims by 4-1 in the region. 5-1 worldwide, 4-1 in that region. They are outnumbered by Shia Muslims, however, in Iraq by between 2-1 and 3-1. And so long as this proxy war exists, this religious war exists between Sunni and Shia Muslims, and it is armed as it is being now, with Iran supplying weapons on one side and to a large degree even weapons brokered by Russia and China through Iran to the Shia on one side and the United States brokering weapons through Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait on the other, all we're going to have is carnage and death. And ultimately, because they outgun the Shias by a enormous margin, it's more than 10-1, and they outman them by a significant margin, and it's around 4-1. The Sunnis will prevail. The ISIS-like groups will prevail. But at what cost? And then once they prevail in the great jihad, where will they go from there? I'd like to turn our attention to a follow-up on the story of the shooting of the two police officers in the Las Vegas area. It was reported initially that the shooters were neo-Nazis because swastikas had been found in their possession. Does not appear to be the case. They appear to be patriots. They appear to be right-wing patriots, but they do not appear to be neo-Nazis. They did drop swastikas on the bodies of two of those they killed, along with a Don't Tread on Me flag, which was, you know, part of the U.S. Revolution. They, in all likelihood, viewed the police officers as representing a Gestapo, as a nationalized police that was representing the tyrannical government. In this regard, their view of the police as representing the control mechanism of a tyrannical government that was usurping people's freedoms, not unlike the Gestapo did in World War II, though not nearly as extreme, obviously, as the Gestapo. You know, there's some semblance of reason to all of that. But even though there is reason to distrust, to dislike your government and its implements of force, there is never justification for taking their lives. None. You become as bad, if not worse, than they are when you pick up weapons and start killing. Now, the two men that were killed, they did nothing to deserve being killed. They had families. And so the mindset of, I'm going to show my patriotism, I'm going to begin a revolution, we're going to take back our country, and you do so by picking up weapons and killing. All you do is slander your cause. You demean your cause. You cause the vast majority of people to recognize or to view your cause as being not only mean-spirited, but out of touch with reality. So those two who wish to make the association between what has happened with the police forces in this country and the imposition of the government's influence in our lives, they wish to show that by the Don't Tread on Me and identifying the police with the Gestapo tactics. They did their cause an enormous disservice by using weapons rather than words. We have Glenn on the line. I'd like to have Glenn's opinion on this before we go to what I think is one of the most amazing stories of the last decade, something that is earth-shaking in terms of its consequence. Hello, Glenn. How are you?
Good morning, Ed. Okay, thanks. Hanging in there. Just finishing up the night shift, as a matter of fact, and
okay.
Some cleanup and such. The Vegas shootings.
Yes.
There was a third man killed who was a civilian with a concealed carry permit who was attempting to engage the husband and the wife. He was, you know, holding a shopping cart. You know, just jumped in, surprised him from behind, got him. So there were three people dead there.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure the jury's out for me as to whether or not the Gadsden flag part thing is true. I've heard that back and forth as to whether or not that aspect of the story was correct. I'm not as yet sure.
The story about they don't tread on me and the Nazi flags on the bodies.
I've
read so many national articles on them placing the flags on the both the Don't Tread on Me and the Nazi flag on the bodies. And now there's some analysis of it, and the analysis seems to indicate that those who knew what they were trying to convey by them, says that they were not neo-Nazis. They considered themselves patriots, and they were trying to identify the police under the Nazi banner, and they viewed themselves as the Don't Tread on Me revolutionaries, patriots, Tea Party type patriots. Don't Tread on Me.
Well, it's funny, and Tea Party, unfortunately, has been, I think, vilified. And this is why you have so many patriots, the talk radio shows, the shows are always quick to emphasize, you know, we're doing an info war. We do not want to use violence. So, you know, always trying to talk people out of that. And the Tea Party thing, it's an interesting thing because the Tea Party thing, of course, originally meant taxing up already, so that was started by
fairly
reputable, and it's been infiltrated. But now that you had that big Tea Party win against Eric Cantor, I just saw the Rat Fellow interview this morning. So this stuff is all very, very crazy and maddening. That's actually what I called about was the most Mosul evacuation,
mm-hmm.
You know, I had to like do a double take. 500,000 refugees in one day as a result of a group named ISIS, named after a pagan fertility goddess with her
eyes. That certainly wasn't their intent. That wasn't the intent with the acronym, but it is named after a fertility goddess. But the fact is that it's just Islamic State of Iraq and Syria.
Right, right.
It is an acronym.
So broken, and I look at this, and we spoke. I remember one time, a number of weeks ago, about the the ongoing, grinding, chaos-inducing, gradualist effect of this proxy war approach and all this gradual disorder. I mean, we're seeing now we've got cities in Europe being shelled, into oblivion. If you look at picture of Homs, or you look at the pictures in Slavyansk, it's like, wow, bombed out, artillery stricken and bombed out buildings, wow, all over the world. And I just thought back to Genesis 6, as in the days of Noah, the whole world would be filled with violence.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, okay, what I expect is 12 years of this continual grinding, ever building towards a crescendo. And meanwhile, when people like squawk about cataclysm, the huge global cataclysms that never come, while all along the grinding degeneration is happening all over the world.
Yeah, it is the grinding degeneration. I think that's actually the issue behind so many of these recent shootings. It's a grinding degeneration of individual consciousness, a combination of lots of things. One is the ineffectiveness of the psychiatric drugs and of psychiatric treatment, the liberalization of policies so that those who have genuinely have psychiatric issues can't be locked up so that they're not a menace to society. That would have prevented the Santa Barbara killings. It certainly would have prevented the killings up there in Oregon. And then you add to that the ether world of the internet and video games where people go off and they're induced by unreal worlds. And then the lack of personal contact that we have today through all of the Facebook and texting as opposed to actual human contact. And then if you add to that the political correctness that is running rampant in our schools so that no one exercises good judgment, you are getting this broad-based deterioration. We'll be back in a moment. I want to turn our attention to what I think is a stunning change on the American political scene. The 7th Congressional District, which stretches from Orange through Louisa counties in Virginia, from Richmond, Virginia, up to Alexandria, just outside of Washington, D.C., Eric Cantor, who I actually know quite well, was defeated. I think most of the listeners to this program know that at one time I was fairly active in politics, and at one time I was quite wealthy, and therefore I was a magnet for politicians. And I'm now anti-political. I'm going to speak of this in general terms as opposed to advocating a consequence. But I can tell you that having met many, many of the nation's leading politicians, there was no one that I ever encountered that was even in the same hemisphere as Eric Cantor. Eric Cantor is brilliant. Eric Cantor's understanding of the U.S. budget is probably superior to most all of the other congressmen combined. He was a genuine conservative. In fact, it wasn't for Eric Cantor. Boehner, who is Speaker of the House, would have sided with Obama and the Democrats on many issues, that it was only the intellect and research of Eric Cantor that kept him from capitulating. He was the conservative conscience, a man of character inside of Congress. He was hated by the Democrats because he was extraordinarily effective. And he was a stalwart of financial conservatism in the House, trying to rein in the problem that has already killed America. We just don't know that we're bankrupt because of quantitative easing, but we are bankrupt. And it was Eric Cantor that enabled all of this. So you have today the Tea Party, which is, if I were to coin a term, I would call it religious republicanism. The most zealot conservative Republicans that view their politics from a religious perspective. They nominated a man that there isn't five of them that actually know, Dave Brat. Nobody has a clue who Dave Brat is. I mean, he's a professor. He's a professor who ran on a single platform. I remember here about 3 weeks ago, I was going to comment on why in the world the Tea Party was even putting up a candidate to run against Eric Cantor. Because if you're a conservative, which obviously all Tea Partiers are, there is nobody in national politics that is more effective for your cause, particularly as it relates to financial conservatism, than Eric Cantor. And it was just stunning to me that he would even put up a candidate against him. But for that candidate to win, as a conservative Republican, if you are a Tea Partier, as a conservative Republican, as a zealot for Republicanism, you didn't just shoot yourself in the foot. You shot yourself in the brain. There is, first of all, it's unlikely that Brat will win the actual election against the Democrat. He's going to be running against a fellow professor from the same college, by the way. And even if he were to win, there is a 0% possibility that he will be even 10% as effective as Cantor was. So what on earth are you thinking? Well, there are areas of this country where extreme Republicanism, where religious Republicanism can elect people to statewide and to even to national office in certain districts. There is no chance whatsoever that Tea Partiers, religious Republicans, are going to represent so much as 20%, even 15% of Congress and the Senate. And as such, they're always going to be a decided minority. It's impossible for a Tea Partier to win national election. Impossible. And the way America is set up right now in terms of politics is that Republicans represent between 35% and 40% of the vote. Democrats represent between 40% and 45%. The only chance that Republicans have is that middle 10% to 15% of the vote. They have to carry 2/3 of it. And those moderate, middle ground individuals are not going to resonate with the Tea Party. In fact, even a significant swath of Republicans won't resonate with them. They've just killed themselves. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The victor, Dave Brat, said today, this is a miracle from God that just happened. So when I say that the Tea Party is essentially religious republicanism, I'm not kidding. Now, I'm going to tell you, Mr. Brat, that God had absolutely nothing to do with him. With this. You do not know him. He does not know you. He is not engaged in politics. He did not perform a miracle on behalf of a political institution. I know that religious Republicans think that there is no difference between their conservative Christianity and their politics. But I will tell you that while there is no difference between their religious Christianity and their politics, there's a great divide between them and Yahweh. Conservatives, yeah. Well, yes, go ahead, Glenn.
In terms of how this was achieved, though Cantor outspent Bratt by 25-1, Bratt's, you know, supporters mounted a huge, you know, like grassroots door-to-door campaign. They may use sweat equity to make up for the monetary and the financial equity they didn't have.
I don't think so. They mobilized
a large, first of all, a very small percentage of people vote in the primaries to begin with. So they mobilize a larger number of a very small percentage. So you have these disproportionately low percentages turning out by whatever means.
Yeah.
That they mobilize a larger number of a disproportionately small group of respondents that produced the result that gave Bratt the win, which isn't really reflective. And so what you have, because the people didn't turn out, don't turn out for primaries, what you have is a win that doesn't necessarily represent the populace, because the populace doesn't represent itself by voting.
Let me challenge some of those things. Okay, some of the things you've said is true. Cantor did outspend his opponent. Cantor raised $2 million, didn't spend it all. But because he would never spend the money in the primary, because he uses the money to in the actual national election. The principal thing that Bratt had going for him was not a grassroots movement, because the Tea Party does not really have the wherewithal that the Republican Party has in terms of getting people to get out to the vote. It was evidently Laura Ingraham, and every article that I read, even the local town paper and the really the only meaningful town in this area outside of Richmond, which would be Charlottesville, all say the same thing, that Laura Ingraham had a disproportionate influence, and that she kept on hammering away that Cantor was liberal, and that Dave Bratt was a man that would help to take Congress back and take our country back. And so she created a myth that Cantor was too liberal to represent the people of that district. It is true that the primary process is hugely flawed, and it's flawed for two reasons, one of which you mentioned, and that is that you get typically a small percentage. In this case, it was about a third of those who could vote did vote, and they although there were it was a 37% increase in voting in this primary over the primary a year ago. A year ago, Cantor from this district in the primary received 37,000 votes. This time he received 28,000 votes. What isn't said here, and could well be true, is that because Virginia has passed a law that says that Democrats can vote in Republican primaries and Republicans can vote in Democratic primaries, a significant percentage of those who voted, and I read not only the LA Times and the New York Times story on this, but all of the commentary by people in the district who posted to the New York Times site. And what it appears is that a very significant part of this was actually Democrats voting for Pratt, and the reason that they would vote
to scuttle Cantor,
because you've got the one person that can stand up to the and that has stood up to the liberal agenda in Washington has been Eric Cantor. He's it. And so if you remove Eric Cantor, then the rest of it is easy, and the likelihood of Bratt winning the seat, while slim, his chance of having the kind of influence that Cantor had is zero. And so Democrats voted, and that's the reason that there was an increase of vote.
Right, well, and that's a preposterously stupid law, and that's even worse than fielding a deliberately spoiler candidate to split a party. They're all counterproductive, and this is preposterously stupid.
Preposterously stupid. Oh, of course, preposterously stupid. It happens to exist in most states in America that the courts have ruled that, you know, freedom of vote, everybody should be able to express themselves. But in so doing, the Democrats can actually, because they significantly outnumber Republicans now, they can jury-rig their own opponent. The other part of this that is really interesting is that the Tea Partiers are now a single issue religious political party. It was one time that they were focused on the budget, but if you're focused on the budget, you could not have had a better ally than Eric Cantor. Now their single issue is, and it's the thing that you notice I won't talk about on this program, is immigration, and that is their single issue at this point. They want immigration stop. They want all Mexicans who are here illegally shipped back to Mexico. And the reason I won't talk about it on this program is that is twofold. It's like the abortion issue. It's a complete and utter waste of time. There is nothing that's going to be done that can change the status quo. As a matter of fact, the status quo is going to be further entrenched over time. Not the other way around. That at this point, that discussion has been lost because the largest voting bloc in America now is are Mexican Americans. They are the largest voting bloc in America. They vote about 80% for the Democrats because they want open amnesty, they want open borders, and they want all sorts of support programs for those who come from Mexico to the United States, because they are already established as the largest voting bloc. They know that they're going to get amnesty for the next group, which will make them an even larger voting bloc. They cannot be opposed. And they're inflicting a self they're wounding themselves.
Use the numbers to overthrow their damnable narco-terrorist government in Mexico and string up a few billionaire oligarchs down there and then try and make some justice in their own country, but that's never going to happen.
Yeah, never going to happen. Now, one of the issues here is that the United States government is playing along. Most people don't recognize, but it is absolutely true that one of the largest advertisers, if not the largest advertiser in Mexico, is the U.S. government. And you know what the U.S. government is advertising in Mexico?
Military conscription?
Come to America and you can sign up for food stamps. Come to America, you can sign up for welfare. Come to America and you can receive Social Security benefits. Come to America and we have all sorts of programs to make certain that that your needs are met.
So it's deliberately to subvert the labor market.
Yes. Well, not just to subvert the labor market. The government is comprised mostly of those who are comfortable with socialism, who prefer a group behavior. You know, if you look at the District of Columbia and you survey the registered voters there, it's about 90% liberal. And that is because the federal government, not the elected officials, but those who staff positions within government, are naturally inclined to collectivism. They're naturally inclined to be part of a big government. They are the ones who make the decisions on things like government expenditures at that level, and they are doing it not because they're trying to subvert the labor market. None of them are thinking of it that way. They're all doing it because they recognize what I've shared with you, which is that the more Mexicans who are voting as a bloc in favor of Democrats, that they can lure to the United States with promises of food stamps and other programs, then the more difficult it becomes for anyone other than a liberal Democrat to win election. If you look at the state of California,
short-sighted and lack of judgment.
Of course, it is completely it's a self-inflicted wound. They're just literally destroying their own country to have control over who wins elections. But if you look at the state of California is not even contested now in terms of statewide elections, nor in terms of the presidential election. It's not even contested.
Right. Right.
And it's because of this issue. So in immigration, if you are an anti-immigration advocate, you've already lost. There is no way to put this genie back in the bottle. You've already lost that battle. So you really ought not even fight it. There's nothing to gain by fighting it. Moreover, what you end up with is this religious zealous patriotism of it's my country, nobody else can have my country. That kind of patriotism is the kind of thing that ultimately leads to wars and anarchy and the like. It is what breeds what happened in Las Vegas. That's the extension of this. Now, most people might say that's extreme and that most Tea Partiers aren't violent, and I'll give you that. They aren't that extreme, but it is this. It's my country. Nobody else can participate in my country. Everybody that's not like me has to go away. It's a racist position.
Wait a minute. What's wrong with, even in the days of Ellis Island, a good number of people were turned away for immigration into the U.S. It's like, no, we have a way of getting people, legally, brought into this country, naturalized and stuff. So, what's wrong with doing it the right way,
It's because we gave up on doing it the right way some 40 right. years ago when we began with the programs of amnesty and when we began to provide all sorts of benefits to those who were not contributing to taxes. And because now we have this enormous voting block in favor of it, there is no way to go back to what was. So this is our reality. If you don't like it, then stop participating in government. Don't try to change it. It can't be changed. Welcome back to Shattering This. The issue related to illegal immigration was actually lost in 1868. And if you go back to 1868, it's the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And it came about in large part because after the Civil War in the United States, it was determined that the Africans, the slaves that were here, could not be citizens. In fact, there was it's called the Dred Scott v. Sanford ruling, where the majority of the Supreme Court, Justice Roger Taney wrote the majority opinion, held that African Americans, whether slave or free, had never been and could never be citizens of the United States and were excluded from the U.S. Constitution. The same thing was held, by the way, of the native peoples that had been here for millennia prior to 1,000 years, probably, before the arrival of the European colonialists, that they could not be considered citizens of the United States either. And so legislation was passed in 1868 to rid that wrong. And to affirm it, at the time, the 14th Amendment was passed. And the 14th Amendment was also designed to take American territories and to make those who were born in those territories American, and therefore put a majority of people the government could now claim were Americans in those territories. Now, the issue as it relates to the immigration issue today is that of the massive number of Mexicans that have come to the United States, tens of millions, and many tens of millions, most are Roman Catholics. Now, while many are leaving the Roman Catholic Church, most are Roman Catholics. The Roman Catholic Church has been opposed to all forms of contraception. And so they typically have larger families than more children than do any other group of people within the country. And so as they come into the country and they have many children, those children are all U.S. citizens. And since their children are U.S. citizens, even though the parents are here illegally, there is a 0% possibility that the country is going to say, you know, we can't exile the children. They're American citizens. But we're going to send their parents back to Mexico. It isn't going to happen. And that's the reason why amnesty has been passed and they approved and passed in the in our history, is that you, because of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, their children, of which they've had many, are U.S. citizens. They're entitled to all the rights of being a U.S. citizen. And the even the parents are illegal. There's no one that's going to send the parents back to Mexico. And so this is a an issue that if you're a pro, you know, an anti-immigration person and you want to send everybody back and you want to put a wall, a monstrous wall all the way across our border, you want to put the U.S. troops along our border to keep everybody out, you've already lost this battle. I mean, you're going to have to deal with the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and then you're going to have to take the vote away from the largest voting bloc in the country, which are now Mexican Americans. How are you going to do that?
Right. Well, obviously, I don't expect it to be. Actually, what I find disturbing about Dave Brad is his economics. He's a free trade disciple of Adam Smith.
Yeah.
Adam Smith gave us the remark, "Greed is good," from Michael Douglas's character in Wall Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Adam Smith's views were refuted by John Nash, about whom the movie Beautiful Mind was about him. And he was a very brilliant, and he proved, you know, on paper, numerically, PhD-level stuff, that Adam Smith was just quite wrong. But so I would be probably a little more of a fair trader myself. I like things like tariffs and fair trade wages and stuff like that.
Yeah. But you and I probably would have a similar view on trade. My view on trade is, and it's the trade issue is a much bigger issue for America than immigration. Immigration is already lost. So if you're one of those who votes based on immigration, you're absolutely wasting your time. That battle is already, the ship has sailed. But on trade, the fairest way to deal with trade internationally is to allow at very low duties products that are made in countries where the United States has a surplus of trade, where we send more product to them than they send to us. And on countries where we have a large deficit of trade, those goods should be dutied to the point that we receive. We go back to a modicum of equivalency. And so if you applied duties in that way, then you would have a fairer system. We'll be back.